My gosh, it's been 7 years. 7 years since I've started teaching during the summer at the University of Tennessee's College of Law. And I've met lots of wonderful people along the way and had lots of good times. And one thing I've done specifically has benefited this show is that I've taken the opportunity to speak to a number of my colleagues, people like former Supreme Court Justice Penny White and George Cuney, and recently David Wolitz, with whom I spoke about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So today, we're going to have what I'm calling the UT Mashup, Part 1. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's all about the University of Tennessee College of Law faculty.
Your weekly constitutional is hosted by Professor of Law Stuart Harris and underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
One of the great things about teaching at the University of Tennessee's College of Law each summer is all the interesting work that my colleagues on the faculty are doing. And pretty much every summer, I'll issue an open invitation. I'll say, hey, if you're working on something with a constitutional angle, perhaps, or something that's just interesting, give me a shout and we'll sit down and we'll have an interview about it. And I was very pleased this summer when more than the usual quota of faculty members volunteered for this. And today we got two really good ones for you. A little later, we're going to hear from Joan Hemingway, who's a very prominent, distinguished professor of law at UT with a very impressive career before that in practice. And she's going to talk about a very current issue called crowdfunding that you might find of great interest, especially if you're trying to raise some money for your favorite charity. And Greg Stein is going to be our first interview today. And Greg is a fellow who teaches a subject that doesn't sound very constitutional at first glance. He teaches property law. In fact, most of his scholarship is devoted toward property law. Now, get this, not here in the United States, but in China, of all places. What's the constitutional relevance of that? Well, let's ask Greg.
Well, I am Gregory Stein. I am the Associate Dean for Faculty Development and a law professor at the University of Tennessee College of Law. And I teach courses, historically, I've taught courses in property law, real estate finance, and land use.
Well, two reactions to that. First of all, you're kind of my boss then, at least in the summertime, because you got that dean thing in your title. Okay, so I'll try to be nice to you today. The other thing, my gosh, real estate, property law, that sounds like a real snore fest. Why in the world would we talk to you on a radio show about the Constitution?
That's wonderful stuff. it's the way we divide up the assets of the world. We see how people get to control different assets. We see how people have incentives to work. If you couldn't own your farm, you wouldn't want to grow anything on it because anybody could come along and take it. Mm-hmm. So it really gets to the question of how we divide up the goodies of the world.
I've heard it said that property rights, in fact, I think I heard you say it, property rights are the guardians of all other rights.
That is something that I think people in the West believe. Mm-hmm. I think people believe that if we don't have a strong system of property, the rest of our legal system breaks down. Mm-hmm. Part of it is the nature of the home. People need to feel that they have a place that they can go to that's a safe place. And part of it is as an incentive to invest. You're not going to build something or grow something if anybody else can just claim it as theirs.
And the economy is important. If the economy collapses and people don't have enough to eat, the political system soon follows, doesn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, my research in China, that's one of the issues that I've been interested in looking at. Which leads the other?
Well, now you got us to the $64,000 question and the reason that I invited you here today. And that was because when I heard your recent lunchtime presentation on China and on property rights in China, I went in there thinking I was going to have to smile and be polite, but I wasn't. It was fascinating, and there were all sorts of connections to the things that interest me, the political stuff, the constitutional stuff. So would you share with us in fact, let's go to the genesis of it. I think you started out in China on a Fulbright, right?
Yes, I started out in China on a Fulbright in 2003. At that point, I knew virtually nothing, or at least at the time I applied, I knew virtually nothing about China. My area of scholarship was American property law. And I was in China teaching property law to Chinese students, which is another interesting side topic, teaching property law to students in a nation where they don't have a very similar concept of property. But when I was there as a teacher and not as a researcher, I was absolutely blown away by the amount of construction that you see in Shanghai, where we were living. It is a city that claims to be home to one-fifth of the world's construction cranes, which may be true, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it is a city that is booming. It's a city that had fallen into terrible disrepair through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s. And all of a sudden, you have millions and millions of people living in fairly poor conditions and a country that's modernizing. And it's trying to do everything we did in 100 years in 10 or 20. And to some degree, it's actually doing it.
In fact, that was just a specific policy decision, wasn't it? Wasn't there some grand announcement that it was going to be the Manhattan of China?
Yeah, in Shanghai, yes. There's one section of Shanghai called Pudong. Pudong just means east of the river. Mm-hmm. And it's an area that historically was not well-developed. It was largely rural. There were some warehouses and things like that. But it didn't really have the feeling of an urban center the way the west side of the river did. And at the time Shanghai was developing, people in China, particularly the Chinese leadership, saw it as possibly the new financial center for modern China. Mm-hmm. Sure, they retook control of Hong Kong, but I think the Chinese are a little bit suspicious of Hong Kong. They see it as very Western, very British. They wanted to build it themselves. So in April of 1990, the Chinese leadership announced that Pudong would be the new financial center of China. They would give tax incentives, they would give other types of breaks, they would relax land use laws, and the goal was to turn this relatively undeveloped area into the new financial center for modern China.
And you showed some pictures.
Yes.
From just before 1990, I think it was 1987 or thereabouts. Yeah. And then you showed some pictures in subsequent years, and I must say, this is one of those rare occasions when I wish we were on television. Because it was stunning, the difference. Just stunning. It looked as if they'd constructed Oz on the riverbank.
Yeah, and in fact, I've written about this. I refer to it as the city George Jetson lives in.
Oh, really? It does. It does kind of look like the George... What do they call it? Something Metropolis or... I don't know.
Yeah.
Fans of the show will remember what it was called. But yeah, you're right. With these big modern-looking towers, some of them really striking architecturally.
Yeah. Yeah, and American cities developed over a long period of time, so you usually have an architectural mix. You'll have buildings from the 30s, buildings from the 70s. In China, and particularly in this area, everything was built between 1990 and it's still going on. So they're all from about the same era. They all have sort of the same feel to them.
Yeah.
And it really does feel like, when you see the pictures, it almost looks like a drawing and not a photograph.
Yeah, it does. Now that you mention it, it did. I was going to accuse you of photoshopping it all, but then you're a nice guy, so I figured you probably weren't lying. Well, my gosh. So it seems they've got property rights figured out there, or not?
Well, that is the ongoing question. In Western countries, as we were talking earlier, we see property as the guardian of other rights, and property ownership is essential to that. In China, the government still owns all the property except for property owned by agricultural cooperatives, which is not really all that germane to cities. Mm-hmm. So in the city of Shanghai, for example, pretty much all of the property would be owned by the government, and that is still true today.
So this is a point at which we have to remind ourselves that technically speaking, since about 1949, China has been a communist country.
Correct.
And one of the essential aspects of communism is collective ownership by the state of all the means of production, including property.
That's right.
And they more or less just came in and took it, didn't they?
They came in and took it. It didn't happen overnight. It's a big country, and there were different issues in the countryside and in the cities. But certainly by the late 70s or early 80s, either the Chinese government or the cooperatives owned all the land in China.
Okay. So they've taken the property. They own it all. So is it just a matter of granting leases, or is it some sort of agreement between the government owner and then the person who's actually using the property? What is it?
It is an agreement between the owner and the user. It's not exactly a lease. It is called a land use right. And with a land use right, you get to use the property for a period of time, either 40, 50, or 70 years maximum, depending on the use. 70 years is for residential. And you get the right to use the property for that period of time. When you build something on that property, or when you buy something that a developer built on that property, you own the structure. So you actually own the building, but you don't own the underlying land. You only have the land use right.
Well, that sounds like a Western ground lease. In fact, I spent some time in London last summer, and they were telling me that a lot of the city of London is still owned by private landlords. So they simply give a long-term lease, and then the property is improved, and the improvements belong to the leaseholder. Is that what we're talking about then?
It's funny that you say that. When Western lawyers hear how China has structured its property, that's the first thing that occurs to them. And there are some similarities to a ground lease, but it is not exactly the same. For one thing, the underlying reasons are different. Ground leases are used in the West for a variety of reasons, but obviously not the ones that are used in China. Mm-hmm. Some people use it as an estate planning tool. Some people use it as a tax planning device. And there are historical reasons for it. They're very popular in Hawaii for reasons just because of Hawaii's unique history, and mm-hmm. in London, as you said. With the Chinese land use right, things are a little bit different. I don't think there's any tax or estate planning motivation so much as a desire by the government to compromise to allow private citizens to get many of the benefits of land ownership that we were talking about without actually admitting that they're privatizing this asset that they took from the Chinese people over a period of 30 years.
This is the moment when my ears perked up, because my interest in China and my knowledge is basically what I read in the papers, so I'm no expert. But my interest in China has always been between the difference between their communist ideology and the simple fact that they are one of the most capitalistic nations in the world. I mean, it looks like they're going to take over the whole planet before long. In fact, that's what got people in this country, a little bit concerned. In fact, let me draw a contrast. If you think back to the Cold War, one of the great things about the Soviet Union was that it was communistic, because that hobbled them. Okay, I always thought to myself that if we have to be in a contest with another nation, as unfortunate as that was, at least we're in a competition with a nation that doesn't know how to run its economy, and is constantly faltering and having difficulty funding everything and all the rest of it. And eventually, of course, that was one of the many things that led to its collapse. But China, though it certainly remains authoritarian, has pretty much given up on the communist ideology, and now they've become a much more formidable, at least potential, rival. These guys seem to know what they're doing with their economy.
I'm not sure if they know what they're doing or if they're figuring it out as they go.
They've been pretty successful so far, though.
They've been pretty successful, and you've really hit on one of the big issues they face. The reason they are the government, the reason they came to power, is by promising the people of China a communist system, which they delivered for 30 or 40 years. That is their reason for existence. They came to power by revolution with that promise. They can't very well just say, oh, no more communism, because their whole reason for existence, at least initially, was to enforce that system. At the same time, they realized that the system didn't work all that well, and they needed to import some of the attributes of capitalism. So what they are trying to do now, what they're really figuring out how to do as they go along, is walk that fine line between becoming capitalist enough that the economy will take off and people will have the incentive to develop and to invest, while at the same time not really admitting that they're becoming capitalist. Mm-hmm. It is somewhat deceiving when you're there, because you feel at first like you're in a capitalist country, and the longer you stay there, the more you realize that you really aren't. But there are many attributes of capitalism in China today that you wouldn't have seen 30 or 40 years ago, and the government is trying to figure out how to harmonize creating incentives for investment while at the same time retaining enough of their communist roots that they maintain their legitimacy.
Let me go back to that a little bit. You say you go there, it seems capitalistic, and then you realize that you're not. What tipped you off that all these guys in suits were not really capitalist?
Well, you walk down the street and you see real estate developments and you see banks. And if you're on the streets of New York, you know that the real estate developments are probably privately owned. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And the banks are probably privately owned, although there was government involvement in banking during the Great Recession. But by and large, they're private regulated entities. In China, the banks and many real estate developers are controlled either by government entities or by people who are well placed in the government. So if you are buying an apartment in China, you're buying it from a developer that may be partly owned by the government. It was financed by a bank that's partly owned by the government. You're going to go get a mortgage loan from a bank that is partly owned by the government.
Oh, boy.
So
this sounds like crony capitalism to the nth degree.
Well, I think in China, the words public and private are really hard to define.
Mm-hmm.
They're certainly privatized to a greater degree than they were in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. but I don't think they're privatized as much as many Americans think they are. And if you spend a week there, you feel like you are in a very capitalist place. But if you spend 3 months there, you start to realize that it's not, looks can be somewhat deceiving.
You know what this kind of reminds me of? This will sound strange at first, but bear with me for a moment. Do you remember the Godfather movies?
Mm-hmm.
The dream of the mafia in the United States was to have a partnership with a friendly government, and the Batista regime down in Cuba looked like it would fit the bill. And so they were going to put into place some sort of very close partnership between these private criminal interests in the United States and a government that was friendly to them. It sounds like something similar has happened in China, that the private capitalists have made their accommodation with these nominal communists and that everybody's just getting along and scratching everybody else's back. Is that what accounts for these periodic corruption scandals that are erupting across the country?
That's a great point, and other scholars are actually writing in that area. I think many Americans thought that sooner or later there would be enough of a groundswell from the people to throw out or at least modify the government, that people would say, okay, we tried communism, it didn't work very well, now it's time to try something else. And the government has shown great skill, or at least had great luck, at making sure that enough people are doing well enough under the current system that they want it to continue. So in many ways, affluent and middle-class Chinese like the current system. They're doing very well economically. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same political and civil rights that we do, but they have more than they used to and more than their parents did. They may feel like things will change over time, but I think by and large, it's a bargain the government and the people have tacitly reached, and that seems to be working so far.
Hey, every country has a different path, right?
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and as the first part of my UT College of Law mashup, I'm speaking to my buddy Greg Stein, who's telling me all about how things are going in China and the significant political and social implications of what is supposedly communism, but looks a lot like, well, I don't know, looks a lot like the mafia to me. After the break, we'll have a visit from our friends at PolitiFact, and then we'll talk some more to Greg Stein. Stick around. Once again, it's time for us to check in on a fact check with our good friend Lauren Carroll from PolitiFact. Lauren, are you with us?
This is actually Linda.
Who?
Linda. Linda Q.
Linda Q. What have you done with Lauren?
Well, Lauren's somewhere where you don't need to know right now. But
you got her in an undisclosed location?
Shh, yeah.
Well, Linda, it's a great pleasure to meet you as well. So, but since this is our first conversation, who are you?
So I am one of Lauren's colleagues at PolitiFact. Mm-hmm. I recently graduated from the University of Chicago.
I've heard of that place.
Yeah.
That's kind of a slouch institution, though.
Yeah, definitely not rigorous at all.
Yeah, not rigorous at all. In fact, I've heard Chicago is quite the party school.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's where fun lives.
I've actually heard the opposite. I've heard it's where fun goes to die.
Yeah. It's had so much fun, you know, that
right.
It's just...
Well, now that we've established that and your hoity-toity academic credentials, well, what have you got for us today?
So I've got a couple of things. Let's start with some of the serious ones. Mm-hmm. I guess recently I did a fact check about Texas's voter ID law, which has been in the news recently. Mm-hmm. And this was a claim by Hillary Clinton. She said that former Governor Rick Perry, who's of course a presidential candidate right now, signed a law that a federal court...
Well, he's sort of a presidential candidate.
Yes.
Because they made him sit at the...
Not too well, but...
They made him sit at the kiddie table during the first Republican debate, but I see what you're saying. Okay, he's a potential, at least theoretical, opponent for Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton's already attacking Rick Perry. Okay, what you have to say about him?
So, okay, this was actually part of a string of attacks against Republican governors who've tried to, quote unquote, restrict voting rights. But she said specifically of Rick Perry that he signed a law that a federal court said was actually written with the purpose of discriminating against minority voters.
Oh, okay, let's pause there because I know there's lots of controversy about these so-called voter ID or voter security laws.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And there are two issues typically when a court will look at them. One of them is whether it has a discriminatory effect. Mm-hmm. And that's bad enough. But sometimes, I guess, Hillary's saying, in this particular case, that in this particular circumstance, they found that there was an intent to discriminate. That's a much more serious charge.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, this law actually has a really interesting history. It was in limbo for a while because Texas is one of many states that, you know, had historically discriminated against minorities. So the Voting Rights Act said that any changes to voting laws had to be approved by the Supreme Court first. So this was
by the Justice Department. Yeah, that was
sorry,
that was
the
that's all right. That was the old preclearance requirement that's still in effect, but has now been effectively gutted because the court has taken out all the covered jurisdictions under that particular provision. But be that as it may, that's the way it used to be in Texas. Okay.
Right. And so the day that the Supreme Court struck that law down, the Texas Attorney General, who's now the current governor, announced that the law would take into effect immediately. And that's what happened. So a few months later, a bunch of minority rights groups, along with a minority senator from Texas, sued Texas and said, you know what, this is completely discriminatory. And a federal court circuit judge said that, you know what, it's true. It had a discriminatory effect and purpose and constitutes a poll tax, essentially.
Oh, boy.
Yes, and there is a lot of evidence to this fact. You know, I'm reading from the ruling statement here. The evidence in the record demonstrates that the proponents of the law were motivated at the very least in part because of, and not merely in spite of, the voter ID law's detrimental effects on the African-American and Hispanic electorate.
Oh, wow.
So it's there in black and white. A federal judge definitely said they did this on purpose.
My goodness. Now, before we go any further, it seems to me that was very bad timing for them. You know, the Shelby County case comes out and it effectively takes Texas out of this preclearance requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And on that very day, you're telling me, Governor Perry says, okay, good, we're out. Now we're going to start enacting laws.
Yep. Just a correction there. It was Governor Greg Abbott who's Perry's
his successor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, excuse me. I'm glad you corrected me on that. Okay, so it's Governor Abbott who does that.
Yes.
Well,
Perry signed it into law first, and then it couldn't take place until the striking down of the Voting Rights Act.
Okay, now I see. Yeah. So Perry was involved with the original passage of that statute, and then it was Abbott who then said, okay, now we're going forward with it. So Perry was involved in this.
Yes, definitely. He was.
So
definitely.
At least in theory, Hillary's saying that this law that he signed had an intent to discriminate. So how did you rate this claim?
We rated this claim mostly true. And that's because it's very carefully worded. She said, a federal judge said, and that part's literally true. A federal judge did say that, but it's a bit misleading because it seems like, you know, this is the end of the law. But at the time that Hillary Clinton made this claim, the law's fate was still unknown. You know, that's recently changed, but she said this in like early June. So at that point, the law was still tied up in the courts.
Okay, so it's primarily a true thing, but to what extent is it not true then? Why is it not completely true?
It's not completely true because we felt like the way that she had worded her claim implied that, you know, even all of the federal courts said that Perry discriminated against minority voters in Texas when the case was, there was a bit more disagreement in the courts than
okay. Were there subsequent appeals and things? Were there subsequent?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And did the case get reversed partly or?
Yeah. Although that part's a bit unclear as well, because the Fifth Circuit of Appeals permitted the law to remain in place for the 2014 midterm elections, in part because it was just a really quick overturn. So they didn't want to confuse voters by saying, now you can, you know, like the whole back and forth thing was an issue.
Okay. So now I see what you're saying is that there's more complexity to this case than Hillary Clinton's statement seems to suggest. But if you simply look at her statement, then what she said was true.
Yes. Yes. That's
okay,
a great way of putting it.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to understand it. So mostly true.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Linda Q, thank you very much for sharing that fact check with us. And, you know, if you're going to keep Lauren in her undisclosed location, maybe you and I can talk again sometime.
Yeah, sure.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now it's time to finish up our conversation with my colleague and my buddy Greg Stein over at the UT College of Law. Greg's been telling us all about real estate law in China. Yeah, I know. That's kind of strange, isn't it? But it turns out that, as Greg likes to say, property rights, at least in the West, are considered to be the guardians of all other rights. And China doesn't really have legal property rights, but they've got lots of customs and traditions. And he's on the ground trying to figure it all out. Let's finish our conversation with Greg, and then we'll have another discussion with Joan Hemingway, another one of my colleagues, as part of this UT College of Law mashup.
Okay, well, let's get back to the law then. So they've got these, in your area particularly of research, they've got these land use rights that they've purchased. And if I recall from your presentation, they had to pay for them up front.
They do have to pay for them up front, and they're almost impossible to finance. So the number of people who can actually acquire land use rights, particularly on valuable urban land, is pretty small. It's people who have a lot of money to start with.
Now, you mentioned that in your presentation. It's almost impossible to finance them. I would think it would be easy to finance them because you're getting a really valuable right. Is it because the same banks that would finance them are actually from the government or represent the government?
Yeah, there are actually legal restrictions on financing land acquisition. You can finance construction, which is true here.
That's because the communist government wants the money to come from somewhere else, not from government-owned banks. Is that a fair statement or not?
I'm not sure. It may be that they want to make sure that every developer has enough of an investment in the property that they have something to lose.
Okay. Skin in the game.
Yeah, skin in the game.
It's almost like a down payment.
Yeah, yeah.
And, okay,
and,
now I understand.
And in U.S. developments, developers have to have a certain amount of investment, too. But usually you would see an American developer borrowing money for acquisition funds as well. And that's pretty unusual in China.
Okay, so the only people, at least in very expensive places like Shanghai, who can get these land development rights are going to have sources of capital either from themselves or elsewhere.
Yeah, that's certainly true today. It may not have been true when things started, but it's certainly true today. And they're also going to need good connections with the government because those land use rights are very desirable and the government controls their distribution.
Okay. So if I'm a Chinese magnate, and I've got a chunk of cash, and I buy my land use rights. I've just bought 70 years worth of right to use this property. So then I go out and I get my developing buds, maybe some of my friends in government, maybe some of the same people who just approved this deal, and we all put together some sort of consortium, and the next thing you know, the cranes are there and the building's rising, and now I'm renting it out, the money's flowing in, everything's great, but then 20 or 30 years go by. What happens then?
If it's residential property, you're probably not renting it out. You probably sold it. Okay. The interests are more like condominiums. So okay. What would happen 20 or 30 years down the road is you have a high-rise building with a couple hundred people living in the building. Each one of them owns their apartment. And if you look at the building, it would look like a condominium in New York or Washington. And they own their unit, and they have their land use right, their share of the land use right to the underlying land. The big question is what happens when the land use right starts to near its expiration date. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese property law, property rights law, which only dates back to 2007, does not answer that question.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
So theoretically, at least, if I'm a condo owner, I might be looking at losing my condo effectively or getting it to the point where I really can't use it, can't sell it, can't do anything with it because it's getting close.
Yeah, when it's getting close, you're going to have trouble renovating it. No bank is going to want to lend money to you. You're right. Going to have trouble selling it because the buyer knows you've only got a few years to go. And you don't really have much incentive to fix it up because it's almost like you're leasing it for another year or two. Why would you be putting money into it if you don't know you're going to get to stay there?
Right. And so those things, even though the ultimate expiration of most of these things is still decades away, we're getting to the point where people are starting to think about it.
People are starting to think about it, and I've been talking about residential property. For industrial and commercial property, it's only 40 or 50 years.
Oh, shorter term.
And
well,
some of these,
we're well into those.
Yes, some of these date to the late 80s or 1990s, so we're starting to get there.
Oh, boy. And so are those buildings actually starting to decay? I mean, is there actual issue in terms of maintenance not being done and investment not being kept up?
There's not a lot of maintenance on these buildings anyway. I think the concept of maintaining property is newer to Chinese than the concept of owning it. I just think it's not like in the U.S. where people are constantly renovating and repairing. So as a starting point, renovation levels are not the same there as they are here. Plus, the construction quality is not as good because it's not seen over as carefully.
Oh, okay. So there is some deterioration.
There is considerable deterioration. Even relatively new buildings often look pretty shabby pretty quickly. But there's also an underlying concern of what's going to happen when the land use right expires.
Yeah, and that might have influenced those attitudes from the very beginning. Even if you've got 40 whole years, you're figuring, I'm going to have a slapdash factory here. I want to get as much value out of it as I can. After a certain point, I'm not going to put another penny into it. And I'm just going to keep running it until the walls start to collapse, and then I'm out of here.
Yeah, and for the residential, the developers who plan to sell it probably figured it only has to look good for the first year or two, because by that point, they're long gone and the owners have the problem of maintaining it.
So you're saying Chinese and American condo developers actually have something in common there. sorry, and I didn't mean to insult anybody. Okay, so now we see the problem, and we see the disincentive of the communist, nominally communist government to reform this. But obviously something's got to happen. What's your crystal ball tell you? Are they going to reform these property rights?
There are several questions. One is, are they going to renew them? The only thing the law says is that for residential rights, they have to renew them. For commercial and industrial, it's not stated. Okay. Even for residential, though, there's nothing in the law that says whether or not they can charge for a renewal. Because remember, the owner has already paid for a 70-year right, but they haven't paid for more than that. They have not paid for more than that. And if there is going to be a charge, which there probably is, nobody, certainly not the property rights law, tells you how that would be calculated.
And that's a huge issue from both perspectives, obviously, but from the government perspective, I think you said in your presentation that this has been one of the primary sources of government revenue for the past several decades. It's rather like the various states or the national government here in the United States having sold off Western properties and made money off of them initially. You can only do that once. If you actually sell it in fee simple, that's a fancy legal term for it in its totality, you can only do that once. Now, they've done something here that might be a neat trick. It looks like they've sold it, but not completely, and they're going to want to sell it again. Except, will the property owner stand for that?
Now, that's a really interesting question. I think the government only sold 70 years because of their concern that they couldn't really admit up front that they were selling the property in fee simple, in absolute ownership, because communist doctrine did not coordinate well with communist doctrine. And it's not clear what they will do in year 70 when all the people who objected have long passed from the scene. I think it's fair to say that property owners, land use right holders, expect that they're going to be able to get the rights renewed and probably at a moderate price. So from their perspective, they're looking at it as something very close to ownership. The government, as you noted, is running out of cash because they provide...
Well, actually, you noted it. I'm just parroting what you said, but go on, please.
The government, as you quoted me as saying, has been funding its capital improvements, its bridges and its tunnels and its highways and its airports, plus a lot of its ongoing operations, its salaries and things like that, out of the proceeds of sale of land use rights. Most places in China do not have a property tax, at least not yet. They're just starting to experiment with that. So instead of taxing property owners the way Western nations do, they've been selling off assets. And they're running out of good land already, and it's not clear what's going to happen at the end of the 40 or the 50 or the 70 years. From the government's perspective, they're going to need the money from a resale. But I think a lot of the rights holders, particularly residential, are not expecting to get hit with another big bill for land that they feel they already bought.
Sure. Now, the one solution that seemed to me, you suggested as one option among many, and the one that seemed to me that I think maybe would be the most attractive, is to maintain the current fiction, and we're only going to renew these rights. Okay, that's fine. So everybody's happy we're still communists, right? But instead of making people come up with another big lump sum, say, okay, we're going to annualize this, and you're simply going to pay us in perpetuity this relatively small amount of money. What you've effectively done is you've instituted a property tax system. But it's much easier to pay an annual, reasonable, moderate property tax than it is to pay a lump sum. And moreover, since it's in perpetuity, in theory, you've solved your funding problem for if you're the government. I mean, you're going to get a predictable stream of income for as many years as you care to calculate. And of course, as governments always do, in a few years, the rates go up slightly, right? Okay, so now you got effectively a property tax system, but we're all still communists.
I think of the many possible outcomes, the one you just described is probably the most likely or one of the most likely. Mm-hmm. I don't think the government is ready yet to admit that they sold off the land, and I'm not sure whether they ever will be. That's hard to predict. At the same time, I am quite confident they want to avoid the upheaval that they would face if homeowners suddenly discovered that they didn't own their homes anymore. They own the building, but they didn't own the underlying land. And the last thing the government wants is to face a revolution from the people. That's how this government came to power, and it knows that it could lose power the same way.
Oh, yeah. In fact, again, that was what really piqued my interest. They are walking a fine line.
Yes.
Thus far, they've placated the middle class, and I guess their continued viability depends upon their continued ability to do that. And the worst thing you can do to somebody in the middle class is threaten his home. or his livelihood in some fashion. So again, that's why it seems to me the most plausible outcome here. And if I recall, also, you're kind of inventing a lot of this stuff, or at least you're one of the few people who's writing this stuff down. Because most of what you've described, if I understood your presentation correctly, is kind of unwritten law. People are operating under these rules, but a lot of the stuff really isn't formalized.
That is true. As I mentioned, the property rights law only goes back to 2007, and modern China has been developing since the late 80s or early 90s. So to a large degree, they were constructing new buildings without full confidence that anybody knew what the law was. Mm-hmm. And that's a very risky thing to do. I think as a substitute for written law, there were several other features that are not necessarily unique to China, but they're all found there. There is a fair understanding of informal law, and there were other business laws at the time. So even though there was no property law, there was a growing number of laws being adopted by the Chinese government. So there were some laws. There's a system based to a large degree on personal connections more than rule of law. We think that the law determines relationships, and in China, I think it's much more personal relationships. So I think to the extent people knew each other and were working with people they had worked with in the past, people they went to school with, they felt confident that things would work out even though there was no written law necessarily to support them.
You're making it sound, Greg, like an entire nation that operates like a small Midwestern American town or southern county someplace. You know, everybody knows everybody else. They all played football together back in the day. You know, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. You know, we just kind of get along. Everybody gets along with each other. And as long as you're well-connected and you start out with a little bit of money, then everything works out pretty well. How about the common people? Did you have any contact with the common folk in the sense that the people who don't have these rights, the people who might not even be able to afford their own homes, how are they getting along in China? How does this affect them?
That's a really interesting question, and let me divide the common people into two groups. You've got relatively poor people in the cities and relatively poor people in the countryside.
Yeah.
The relatively poor people in the cities, I think, by and large, are seeing their incomes go up. The cities are booming. There's plenty of work, even if it's not skilled work. And financially, they're doing well. Now, some of the places they lived downtown have been redeveloped, and those folks maybe got some very small amount of compensation and had to live somewhere else. So they may not be happy about how their change in residence was handled. But by and large, living standards have gone up. So you're seeing old, very low-quality housing units being replaced by much more modern ones, but at the same time, destruction of old neighborhoods. Yeah. So that's a mixed blessing, but I think financially they're doing better than they were, even though there have definitely been trade-offs. The agricultural side is different. Property rights in agricultural land are controlled by a somewhat different system because those have historically been owned by, or at least since the 1949 revolution, have been owned by agricultural collectives. And those are the traditional communes you think of as being what a communist system is all about, where a bunch of people work together in agricultural production. Those folks are in a different situation because that land cannot be used for urban development. That land is owned by the cooperative. And while there has been some conversion of agricultural land to urban land as cities have expanded, that is really still a process that's developing. There is a very stark difference in incomes in the countryside and in the cities. The other thing you're seeing in China, which is really unprecedented anywhere, is movements of tens of millions of people from the countryside to the cities for better work.
Years and years ago, 30 years or more ago, when I studied a little bit about China in college, there was that difference in living standards. And at that point, this was back in the 1980s, my understanding was that the Chinese government actually restricted that migration. They wouldn't let people move from the country to the city. But apparently that restriction has been lifted to some
extent.
Well,
not officially, at least not officially everywhere. In China, you have a work permit, and the work permit is tied to a place. And that is the place where you have your job, that is the place where you have your home, where your children are educated, where you get health care, where you have your retirement funds. So officially, that system has not been lifted, although there have been some experiments with modifying it. What that means is for many people who want to move from agricultural areas to cities, they have to move without documentation. And in many ways, what you're seeing in Chinese cities is not all that different from what you're seeing in American cities with undocumented workers, except the ones in China are Chinese. They're Chinese citizens who just can't relocate without permission. Oh. What that means is you have workers who are in a position to be taken advantage of.
Yes.
So
for many of the same reasons that we don't have immigration reform here, the powers that be are tolerating it there.
Exactly right.
Somebody, nice big cheap labor force that you can abuse the heck out of.
Somebody has to build all those buildings. And what you see a lot of is couples move to the city, or sometimes only one half of a couple moves to the city. The men, by and large, take construction jobs. And to the extent they don't get paid, they don't have a leg to stand on because they're not there legally.
Right.
The women, to some extent, are working in factories. Your iPhone was probably built in China by women who moved from agricultural areas to the city where the factory is.
Don't make me sad. Don't make me start taking responsibility for my consumption now, Greg. Now go on, please.
So what you're seeing is millions and millions of people moving from agricultural areas where they just can't make very much money to off-the-books jobs in urban areas where they can make a lot more money but have a lot higher risk. Their children can't necessarily go to school there because they don't have the work permit for that place. They live in unofficial housing. Some of the construction workers live on the job site. I mean, you walk by a building under construction in China, you will see laundry hanging from the building. So it is really not all that different from the immigration issue in the U.S., but again, we're talking about people who are Chinese citizens.
Well, that certainly is the unpleasant underbelly of all of this rapid economic growth,
isn't it? Certainly is.
Well, Greg, this has been absolutely fascinating. I understand you've been back to China many times since your initial Fulbright back in 2003. When's your next trip?
I don't know when the next trip is, but hopefully in a year or two, I'd like to go back and see how things changed. One of the remarkable things is every trip to China, something is really different from what it was last time because things are changing so fast there.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And wasn't that a great conversation on an unlikely topic? Greg Stein studies property law in China. And you're thinking, what does that have to do with the Constitution? Well, it has an awful lot to do with our Constitution and with our constitutional rights. But you know, similar things over in China, and certainly lots and lots of political and social implications, and a very timely interview, unexpectedly timely. When I was talking to Greg, the Chinese stock market was in the middle of a collapse, and it looks like the whole Chinese economy may be going south now. At any rate, after the break, we'll come back and we will speak with another one of my UT colleagues. Her name is Joan Hemingway, and she knows all about crowdfunding. So stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time for another one of my UT College of Law colleagues. Her name is Joan Hemingway, and she is a distinguished professor of law at UT, and she is studying something that you may be familiar with, something called crowdfunding, and it turns out it has lots and lots of legal and even perhaps constitutional implications.
I am Joan Hemingway. Mm-hmm. I'm the W.P. Toms Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Tennessee.
You're not just a professor of law. You're a distinguished.
I'm a distinguished professor of law. I don't look it. I don't look a day of it. Let's put it that way.
Distinguished,
implies some age.
But I see. So you're the young and distinguished.
I am the young and distinguished, yes.
Okay, tremendous.
Title given to me, hopefully for good work done, and hopefully I'll keep it for the same reason. I used to practice law, though, for 15 years before I came here at UT, to UT in 2000. I practiced law at Skadden Arps in their Boston office for 15 years.
Skadden Arps.
Finance.
Very familiar name.
Yes.
To those
a large multinational law firm.
Right. And does lots of securities work.
Does lots of securities work and corporate finance work. And I was blessed by having that as a background. And now I teach hopefully what I learned and what I've learned since.
So you left New York City? Is that where you
actually,
were?
Actually, Boston.
You
I
were
was
in
the Boston,
Boston
office.
Okay. Another one of those evil eastern cities.
That's right.
You left the big city and came here to God's country.
I did.
And now you're propagating the gospel here among your students.
Indeed I am.
What really caught my attention, Joan, and thanks, by the way, for taking time to talk to me about this, is that among the many interesting things you do, you're doing some very interesting work in something called crowdsourcing.
Crowdfunding, even.
Crowdfunding, excuse me.
The funding part of crowdsourcing.
Right, it's actually the
it's
money.
About the money.
The money part of
it. It's all
that.
About the money.
Absolutely. Okay. What exactly is this crowdfunding that you're working so hard on?
Well, it's crowdsourced money, really. And what does that mean? What it means is that there are a lot of businesses and projects out there that are challenged by not being able to find enough funding. The classic example, of course, is the garage business, like Apple, Microsoft, starts with a few important, nice guys, but they have the idea and they don't have the money. And it's harder and harder in a global world to find the people who give you the money once you've exhausted, your friends and your family and The community, any folks you know in the community. So the internet seems like the logical place to go, right?
Traditionally, people who wanted to embark on some sort of venture
right.
would have come up with this idea, and then they would go through traditional investment banks
right.
who would then hook them up with what we call venture capitalists or investors. And so the job that was traditionally done by those investment banks is now being done on a wider basis, or at least to a wider public, by these crowdfunding sites. Is that a fair statement?
Indeed, yeah. It's sort of a mix of social media and e-commerce. Mm-hmm. You're bringing folks together that would not be part of that venture capital network that you just described, that wouldn't receive angel fund investing, that wouldn't receive traditional venture capital investing, that wouldn't be in the public market for securities. But it's a great idea. It's a great project, and it deserves to be funded. And there are people out there that, if they knew about it, and the internet's a great place for people to find out about stuff they don't know about, if they knew about it, they'd give money to it. So that's really how crowdfunding was born.
Okay. Now, you know a lot more about this area of the law than I do. I've never worked in investment banking nor in securities law, so I know basically what I learned in law school 30 years ago. But it seems to me that those investment banks, that entire traditional process is highly regulated. What about these websites? Is there any regulation? Is there any protection for investors or any requirements for the people who want to go out and start these new ventures?
Sure, of course there is. It varies. So if you look at this as a traditional venture capital type vehicle, what's being offered in venture capital funding is stock or debt that's classified as a security. Mm-hmm. So federal securities law reaches in for those kinds of instruments and other things that look like them that generate profit to the funders, who mm-hmm. we call investors, basically, in securities regulations. So basically, in the United States, and that's the area that I'm the most familiar with, it differs in other countries, but in the United States, we don't have securities crowdfunding right now. You can't do investing like that on the web. Now, we should, in a funny sense, because Congress, in the Jobs Act back in 2012, enacted legislation to facilitate that, but it's dependent, in terms of it coming into full force and effect, on Securities and Exchange Commission regulation, which hasn't happened yet.
That hasn't happened. So we're waiting on what the law is supposedly going to look like in the future. But right now, there's not a lot of regulation of these things.
Well, so there's loads of other crowdfunding out there. So mm-hmm. if you think of, instead of getting money back, interest on debt or dividends on stock or being able to participate in selling an interest like that in the market for money, if you think about just wanting to give money to the next best thing and maybe getting back. So suppose it's this indie band that you just love, right? Mm-hmm. And they want to produce a new set of recordings, but they need the money to do that. How are you going to find out that they need that? Well, if they jump on the internet and they say, hey, all fans, come on in and give us some money and we'll give you front row seat at a venue where we're going to play these recordings.
So that's what's going on in these crowdfunding sites. They're not giving you the traditional interest in their business,
right?
Which we'd call a security.
That's correct.
A stock in more common parlance.
Or a debt.
Or debt. They're not giving you a bond. They're not promising to pay you back at a certain interest rate. They're simply saying, hey, we'll give you this really cool seat assignment at our next concert.
Yeah.
Or maybe we'll let you listen into our practice tracks before we release them to the public.
Or a free set of MP3s. You know, you don't have to pay the 90 cents a piece or whatever they are on the web. So you could do that. Or better yet, so there are some people that just think that indie band is so good, they're willing to put $10 in and get nothing back.
Okay.
They're willing to donate.
So certainly it can be a donation
thing.
That's actually what I'm familiar with. Yeah. Actually, a young person who recently graduated from college had some need and mm-hmm. crowdfunded for it. And I contributed and was happy to do so. And I always just considered it a charitable contribution. But I did notice that I was eligible at certain levels to get certain perks.
Yes.
And now I understand that that is the quid pro quo that's typically offered here in lieu of debt, in lieu of securities.
Yeah, and some of it's not perks at all. So you may have, you may be familiar with all of the news reports over the years about families in an area where something happens. There's a crisis. Someone needs a medical procedure. Someone needs something, right? And it always said, hook up on our website, whatever the letters are, call letters are for the radio station or the TV station, and they advertise for you to be able to send a check, to that
right.
family. that's now being done through crowdfunding. So you can crowdfund your own medical procedure. You can crowdfund your family's financial crisis. And for that, what you get is a good feeling. I did the same good feeling you would get by writing that check and sending it off to Channel 8 News or something like that. So it's a wide range of things. And those other areas are regulated, just like with a lot of stuff on the internet, we regulate the behavior, not the fact that it's done on the internet to a great extent. So charitable donations are regulated on a state-by-state basis. These perk kind of transactions where you get a little something in return, a product, a service, they're consumer transactions. And so the FTC and state consumer protection laws.
So there are regulations out there.
Absolutely. They cover this space, but patchwork. It's a patchwork based on the type of crowdfunding that's being done.
And you would like to see this considered in a more systematic fashion?
Yes. I think it's the regulation is developing ad hoc. Just like with so many other things on the internet, the behavior of people on the internet basically has gotten way out ahead of law and regulation in all of these areas. And part of it is that we don't understand what the space really looks like. It's mm-hmm. a varied space that's been developed organically by individual projects, people that need funding, and the people that want to fund them. And these websites that are crowdfunding platforms have sort of emerged to fill that void and draw these people together that want to be part of a funding experience from one side or the other.
And there is, of course, great potential for fraudulent behavior, because even though it's not traditional securities or bonds,
right,
money is exchanging hands. And I think that you were telling us here at the College of Law recently during your presentation that there's one really egregious example of someone claiming that he was developing a board game and raising all kinds of money for it. And then it turns out there was no board game.
Right. It turns out that the project never happened. And the Federal Trade Commission did, in fact, this was a few years ago, start investigating. And after 3 years, came to a settlement recently in the beginning of June 2015. It came to a settlement with this person who made a lot of promises on a crowdfunding site that he basically couldn't keep.
Right. And that's fraud.
And it doesn't, you know, it can be securities fraud. It can be common law fraud. It can be a codified version of fraud under consumer protection law.
Right.
But it's still recklessly or willfully making a promise you can't keep.
Okay. Well, on the show, and listeners to the show have probably heard us talk about the First Amendment in the internet. Mm. And there are certain, you know, bars to regulating what people say on the internet, just as there are bars to regulating what people say generally. But my guess, based upon what you've told me, is that even though all of these activities involve some sort of communication, it's pretty well established that the state, the government, can regulate these transactions because of the potential for fraud.
Sure. And because it's interstate commerce, right? Interstate commerce is the, you know, the amoeba that ate
everything.
Right.
Exactly.
And business law. So
right.
For me, when I look at this, there will be things I'm sure that will bump up against the line. Mm-hmm. There, for example, and I mentioned this in the presentation that you just referenced a minute ago. There was a woman who wanted to fund a medical procedure on the web, and she because it was a controversial medical procedure and deemed to be optional by a lot of people, and you can guess at what that is. Mm-hmm. She basically brought some infamy on the crowdfunding site that was allowing her to post this particular project that she wanted funding for, and so it drew a lot of negative attention to her. So the project itself shut down her speech by screening out her project from the kind of project that can be funding. And there are policies. So there's a lot of private regulation going on here. There's the public regulation that has got to live sort of within constitutional means. But these are businesses. And so
right.
they can invite people to the party that they want to have at the party, and they can screen people out that they don't want to have at the party. And some of that is speech screening.
Sure, that's a whole nother subject, but it's obviously very closely related to the extent we rely upon these social media platforms or these crowdfunding platforms to allow us to speak. And to the extent that they don't allow us to speak, then they're censoring what we say.
That's right.
And even though they're not government entities, that's still a big, big issue these days.
Right.
And that's our show. Wasn't that fun just talking to a couple of my buddies over at UT? Thanks so very much to Joan Hemingway telling us about crowdfunding and Greg Stein telling us all about those important property rights or quasi-rights over in China. I was looking at my calendar again. Don't forget, this Saturday, September 19th at Montpelier, Constitution Day. Be there or be square. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American Experiment.